Subcommittee of General Government, Joint Ways and Means. We'll continue on with the public hearing on Senate Bill 5542 for the Department of Revenue. Yesterday we were on page approximately 27, 28, dealing with the income tax section. Director Harshenko.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. Today we're going to go in depth on three areas in our programs, income taxes, which again includes both the personal and corporate tobacco taxes and the property tax system. There were several questions that were presented yesterday that we will answer in one of two ways. Either if the question and answer fit nicely into the discussion we're going to have today, we'll just fold it in as at the appropriate point in time, and for questions that came up yesterday where there's not a convenient connection point today, Jim is going to answer those when we shift.
And the perhaps rest of the when, members. Yeah, and perhaps when the rest of the members are here, that would be more appropriate. Thank you. Please proceed.
So that's how we'll proceed. So I'm on page 28, Mr. Chair. Just a reminder that we have those five big blocks of activity that we engage in order to bring in the general fund dollars. And on page 29, you've seen this graph before. Jim talked about it yesterday concerning the effect of our use of technology. It's here now to show you the continuing improvement in the rate of return on investment in our revenue agents. So the top graph shows you dollars collected per revenue agent full-time equivalent per month. And as we make technology improvements, we increase the productivity of those staff by taking away manual processes and giving them automated support systems and collection tools.
To a feel for what may have happened relative to the accounts closed during 1997 through 99, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If you recall, during that time period, there was some litigation involving the taxability of federal retiree federal retirement benefits received by federal retirees in the state, and there was a class action, and a resolution of that class action required a substantial amount of refunds. We pulled people off of other work in order to get those refunds out. So the cases closed in the collection side sat for a while we focused on getting those federal retiree tax refunds out. So that's what happened. That's what that dip is on the lower graph.
And then the drop of the steep growth right at the end of 99, 01 relative to the collections per FTE?
Well, what what happens is, and this is, I think, true of any time you do an innovation, when you make an innovation in your process where you make a significant change, you're going to see a fairly dramatic growth in your production. Then as that matures and all you're doing is making incremental change, the production growth slows. And so that's why we have to continue to look for opportunities for innovation in order to keep that on a general upward trend. But what we had in the 98 to 2001, as I mentioned yesterday, we were working on making sure that all of our systems were compliant with year 2000. And so we weren't putting development resources into improvements in our integrated tax accounting system.
Okay.
And then once we went in and we did that, then the curve starts to go up again, and then with the addition of the Treasury Offset Program, that's included productivity some more. Mr. Chair, yesterday you asked a question about our sister states and their IT spending and productivity increases. And because of the differences in tax structures across the country, the revenue agency directors, my peers around the country, haven't tried to develop an apples-to-apples comparison because the sales taxes, income taxes, varying reliance on those different taxes. But I can tell you that we talk a lot about technology investments. And what is happening around the country is that every revenue agency is looking at technology to assess how productivity can be increased by using those tools within resource limitations and using the dollars responsibly. And what I've learned is that there are lots of different types of applications that are being developed, and some states take the lead and then others benefit. And let me tell you just one story that is one where another state has taken the lead and we've gotten the benefit. About 4 years ago, Indiana pioneered what's called a 2D barcode return. And if you look in the resource materials in the binder at page, I think it's 2-15. No, not 2-15. Is it? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Okay. That is a 2D barcode, a return. And when people use computer software to prepare an income tax return, we have worked with the vendors who provide that, the private software companies that provide those software applications commercially, to include programming that generates this code. And we can use a laser scanner to scan the barcode, and it avoids data entry so that we can process returns that come in paper. People print them out and then send them in, but because it's got the code on it, we can scan it. And Indiana made the investment, pioneered the technology, started to share it. As it got a little more mature, we talked to them about, you know, how we could use it, sent somebody to Indiana to look at their system, and we did a pilot last year with short form returns, and this year we're using it for the full return. So we expect that over the next year or so we're going to see significant gains in productivity in the amount of time it takes us to process documents.
So the major vendors have 2D barcode then, mm-hmm. in their software then.
Right. They put it in the software, in the commercial software that's used by tax preparers if they print out paper returns for their clients to file, or by people who buy off-the-shelf software.
And when have we had the bar scanning equipment?
We started last season. So that's one example of sharing the... We don't have to reinvent the wheel in every state. We're sharing the developments in technology. Oregon has been a little bit ahead of other states in integrating tax systems. One of the things that we did early in the 90s was develop our accounting system so that we could look at an individual taxpayer and know what all of their accounts were doing, whether if they had an individual account, if they say they were in a timber business and they had a timber tax account, or if they were a small business person and had employees and had a withholding account. We integrated all of our accounting systems so that we could look at them all together. Some states still aren't there yet, and I'm doing that integration. So everybody's kind of in different places. But we do share anecdotally. We do talk about the experiences we've had, what's working, what's not working, information about vendors, if people are having really good success with a vendor. In fact, we're investigating some software from a vendor out of Michigan that looks really promising. So it is being shared across the country.
Good, great.
The buck's back.
Yes.
The buck's back, yes. You'll notice that at the 45% or 45-cent level, George got a haircut.
Mr. Chair, I know that many of us have days off in districts scheduled coming up, and the buck is going to be one of my handy outies.
Good.
So thank you.
You're welcome. we still had copies, so I asked for a set for the group, and if you need extras, let us know.
Cool.
Turning to page 30, the graphs here show you that we are making gains in our document handling. The volume of documents coming in for us to process has increased by about 18% over the last 10 years. The amount of time we spend processing them has decreased about 7% over that same period of time. And the reasons for that include using technology. Electronically filed returns don't have to go through our pipeline. You don't have to open an envelope. You don't have to take contents out. You know, it's all coming electronically. The 2D barcode is a faster process. Even though it's still paper, it's much quicker to process. Electronic funds transfer by large employers and payroll service companies have been very helpful to us in processing information. And let me tell you one more story. We still do get a substantial number of paper returns in envelopes. And one of the biggest challenges we have is getting them opened and getting the contents out of them and started through the system. And just before the season started, our folks realigned our mail opening machines and are experiencing some significant productivity gains in just the way that we open the mail. So we are always looking for ways to improve the current processes as well as looking for technology improvements that will replace some of the process that we're working on. So we have increased our productivity there by about 27%. I thought you would be interested in knowing, at least as of the end of, I guess about 10 days ago, electronic returns were up about 16% from last year at the same time. So people are using electronic filing. That is allowing us to, again, move more quickly through our process. Also, as of about 10 days ago, we had almost 64,000 of the 2D barcode returns.
64,000, what percentage would the 64,000 represent, Elizabeth?
Of total returns received. We have about 500,000 total paper returns, so a little over 10% of paper returns. Tax due returns, of course, are the later ones coming in. We had the phone lines, I guess, were clogged last night. We had extended hours, and so lots of folks still wait till the last minute. But that 2D return, Representative Johnson, in the resource materials that we gave you earlier, the 2D return is on page 2-27. If you want to take a look at that.
Grocery store barcode. With a whole bunch of embedded data that the provider's information technology is imprinting on that. Gives the information so it can be bar scanned.
We just scan it with a laser. We don't have to do manual data entry from those returns.
And the electronic filed returns, those are up 16%?
Over last year at the same time.
And what percentage is that total of the paper versus paper returns?
Oh, let's see. The paper returns as of the 4th of April was just over 500,000. The electronic returns was over 360,000.
360,000.
Excuse me.
So probably 75% of the returns filed then were electronic.
Mm.
360 and 500,000 being 860,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 360 and 860.
So we're doing really, really well in the shift from, the rudimentary paper to electronic or electronic equivalent.
40%.
And on page 31. Shows you the value benefit of moving toward using technology. When we process a paper return, it costs us about $1.27 to process the return. The computer-generated paper returns, including the 2D barcode returns, are under $1. And totally internet-filed or electronically filed by a practitioner is about 22 cents to process because we don't have to handle anything. We don't have to open, sort, data entry, or file.
Those are provided into your system. How do they get into your system?
They're filed with the Internal Revenue Service, and then the service gives us a download.
And
since we piggyback.
Cooperative piggyback arrangement, do we have to pay anything to the service for that?
Well, that's a question I don't know the answer to, whether we pay for that or not. I think that taxpayer absorbs the cost. But let us check. When Susan gets here, she'll know the answer to that one.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I might, my name is Jim Maneri, the deputy. The one good thing in this area is that the technology has provided a win-win situation. Electronic filing is a lot easier for taxpayers that choose it, for the individuals that choose it. The software will correct errors itself. It's a lot faster. You get your refunds faster that way. And then on our end, we reduce costs.
Jim, are we, as we speed through these processes, and I spoke with Director Hakenk last week about a concern, are we ever refunding a state withholding before we actually have the W-2 on file electronically?
Mr. Chair, presently we can. That can happen. Right now we're working on a project, though, to obtain the W-2 information electronically.
Okay. Is there any what's the experiences of fraud with regard to folks who are filing and demanding and receiving a refund before we've got confirmation that they have, in fact, had a withholding?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the level of fraud has been minor, and we've usually picked it up later. And we have ways that we can pick it up ahead of time. But at this point, we don't have that math. But we expect to in the next few years.
All right. So, and that would be by receiving and entering. What's the due date? The due date on that information is February 28th, isn't it?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So it could be that you would have returns filed either early or shortly after February 28th that would not be entered, but you have systems in place where you're intercepting any or large amounts of fraud, I assume.
Well, to the extent, Mr. Chair, to the extent there is fraud, and we haven't detected large amounts of fraud in proportion, we have picked that up.
And where does that in the system? Where does that get billed through the loss for fraud? It just moves to the Department of Justice immediately. Is that what happens there?
But where we detect the fraud?
Well, no. When after it's detected, if you had someone file and receive a refund to which they're not entitled, does that immediately go back to the taxpayer, or do you go to the Department of Justice early on? And it may be such a small amount, Jim, that it's not even something that you worry about.
Mr. Chair, where we detect fraud.
This isn't your standard, everyday, ordinary cookie cutter kinds of fraud.
No, sir.
It would be more sophisticated on folks that really have a pretty good idea of what they're doing, I would think. I mean, filing early, attaching phony W-2 copies, and receiving benefit. And I know this is happening to the Internal Revenue Service, but they have ways of detecting it, I think, at the Internal Revenue Service level.
Mr. Chair, we have there are a couple of different areas where we take steps to try to detect and prevent fraudulent returns from going out. And one is in the area of suspense. So as a return comes in, whether it's electronic or paper, if it has characteristics about it that in the past have been associated with erroneous refund claims. We've got those built into the system as checks, and the system itself, the automated system, will we call it suspend a return for review by a human being.
The system itself.
The system, we program the system to look for the kinds of things that might be indicators of an inappropriate refund. And so then a human being looks at the return, and if there's anything that needs to be verified either in our records or with the taxpayer, then that return is set aside and put in a process for doing that verification.
Okay.
If we detect something that we think is fraudulent, intentional criminal fraudulent, we call the AG's office immediately. call the Criminal Justice Division of DOJ and say, we're not sure what's going on here, but it really looks fishy to us, and can you investigate?
Are they
that
responsive?
Is they're very responsive. We have excellent service from the AG's office. That is extraordinarily rare.
Okay. Great.
And what we try to do is the preventive. Then the other thing that we have is, again, communication with other states. If any other state is experiencing something that they think is a refund scheme or anything else, then it's on our listserv for the 50 states immediately. Watch for this. We're seeing this in our processing. Watch for it. And then we're able to do some work internally to say, okay, are we seeing anything like this, and how do we watch for it?
I think we've given Representative Johnson three great ideas for fighting future returns. Representative Johnson?
I was just making notes on that.
Continuing on, page 32.
Is that 32. A satisfactory response, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's go ahead and continue.
Okay. Page 32. This is how we've improved our productivity in processing payments. The faster we get them in the bank, obviously, the faster the treasurer is able to invest them, and the faster they're able to be used for state services. Over time, we have moved from a lot of paper financial transactions to a fairly significant amount of money coming in electronically. And so the top graph there on page 32 shows you that we've had a growing amount of dollars that have come in through electronic funds transfer. Now, the large employers and payroll services, and then corporations that have a certain amount of tax liability, have to pay electronically. We also make it available to anybody who wants to do it. But under the statute that set this in motion, there were thresholds of, you had to be pretty big for the first group, and so I think we're down to about $50,000 as the level. But we tried to track with federal, as federal required electronic funds deposits or transfers by payers, we track that as well. But the bottom graph shows you that in terms of volume of transactions, we still have lots and lots of paper, lots of checks, cash, and paper transactions, and that's the smaller employers. There's a lot more small employers than there are big ones, and individual payments coming in from individual taxpayers. So the dollars are, the big dollars are coming in from a smaller group. The small dollars are coming in from a really large group, but we're still making gains there. And of course, every time we do something electronically, that is very helpful.
I noticed that you have cash listed. Does cash still come through the mail on a regular basis?
I don't know about coming through the mail, but it sure comes in across the counter.
Okay.
Moving to page 33. This just is a graphic to show you how much more quickly we can move money when it's coming in electronically. And even when people send us a check, but they send it with a coupon, a pre-programmed coupon, we're able to run that through our automated remittance processing system right away, and the delay really is how long it's in the mail. When we get a check and it doesn't have a coupon with it, then we've got to do some research before we're able to put it in the bank, because we have to be able to tie it to a specific tax program so that the Treasury knows whether it's general fund or not.
I noticed that you've got three bank days there. That three bank days is really holding it after it arrives in the mail in the office.
It's 3 days of internal processing before we can get it in the bank, yes. Moving to page 34, this is designed to show you that we're able to serve more taxpayers now in terms of wanting information through using the Internet. The white boxes on the top of those bars are our Internet website contacts.
The forms and instructions are all available on the Internet.
Yes, all of the forms and publications and instructions are available on the Internet to be downloaded. The 2 years, the 99 and 2001, where you see some pretty big spikes, those are kicker years. A lot of times we get telephone calls about kickers when people hear kicker checks are going to be going out. And then 99 and 2000, again, was the Federal Retiree Tax Refund Project, and that generated a lot of telephone calls. Page 35, this shows you sort of the flow, and actually, is Senator Winters going to be here today? Because she was real interested in accounts receivable.
She will be late, according to the note that I was shooting.
Okay. When she comes in, I'd like to go back to this
also. Can get back on that
for her. Because understanding accounts receivable has been something that's been challenging for me. When taxpayers voluntarily file and report and pay, we bank the money right away. And that would be the arc on the left side of the circle. If they file and they say, I owe money, but they haven't paid, then that goes into our unpaid accounts, into our accounts receivable, and we will start working with the taxpayer on getting payment. If we do an audit and create an assessment, that will create a payment that's due. And if we do filing enforcement, where someone hasn't even filed and we've determined that they should and we set up an assessment, then that all goes into our accounts receivable. Then we work with taxpayers to pay their obligations. Some people, once we get connected with them, will pay the whole thing. Some people will say, I need a little time to pay it. We'll set up a pay plan for them. some people will pay off a billing. And so as funds come in, those then flow into the bank. But we're always setting up new assessments through the auditing process and the filing enforcement process. And we're especially this time of year, as the reporting requirement returns are due today, then we'll get some significant number of returns in the first quarter that show tax due. And so the accounts receivable will swell, and then we'll work it, and it'll go down. And we have some data on page 36 about our personal income tax, which is the biggest share of the liabilities. For the last 3 years, since the 99 session, House Bill 3509, which Senator Winter sponsored, started agencies moving accounts receivable more quickly through their systems and into collection, either with us through our other agency collections program or into the private collection agencies. And this shows you, since the records have started to be kept a little bit better, sort of the how this is all working. Our beginning inventory in the personal income tax system is that top line as of the beginning of each of those years, and then what we've added through audit, filing enforcement, or billings, taxpayers saying I owe it, but they didn't pay it. How much then is available for collection? And then the difference between available for collection and available for private collection is the standard is it has to be at least a year of since the last payment before things go to private collection, and they can't be on hold for any reason. Like if the taxpayer is in bankruptcy, federal law prohibits us from collecting debts. If they're in the hospital or they're incarcerated or for some other reason where we hold off. And we work everything that's less than a year old in our own collections efforts. So we send then out into the private collection agencies everything that's available that 1 year date. Our collection experience, the year 2000 is a little bit odd because we had some non-liquidated debt in there, and now we're on a standard of reporting. So the 2001 and 2002 are apples to apples. And so you see in that first gray bar our experience in terms of our rate of collection of our own debt. And then the lower section is our experience with the private collection agencies and the collections that they've remitted to us over the same time period.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you do any estimates of what you honestly expect to have to write off as uncollectible in the end? I mean, I see it particularly if you go away from personal income taxes to property taxes. Collectibles seem to be carried for a long time there, but sooner or later, it does appear that at least of a fairly high percentage of property taxes are collected. But is there some, I mean, your numbers for the private collection agencies look about average for what we see in other departments in terms of private collection. And I assume you have the same capabilities, as I shouldn't call them capabilities, as the Internal Revenue Service in terms of some of your abilities to collect funds. But is there a fairly significant portion of these that remain uncollectible? I mean, that you ultimately have to write off?
Okay. You asked several questions, and I'll try and respond to all of them.
Okay.
And if I haven't, be sure to let me know which I haven't. Let me start with the tools that we have. We have a wide range of tools that help us in collections, both in terms of locating taxpayers. We have access to a lot of information to locate them, and then we also have a lot of tools in order to get payment. Our experience is that if we work with a taxpayer and their ability to pay, that's going to give us the highest rate of return. But we do have the ability to issue administrative warrants and garnishments for involuntary payment if there is a source that we can garnish. And we also have the ability to do a continuous wage garnishment until a debt is paid. And in the private sector, they don't have those tools. IRS has levy authority that trumps us, but we have some very similar tools. The property tax system is fundamentally different in terms of the collection because of the nature of that tax system itself. The taxes are on primarily real property that doesn't go anywhere. And it's a lien, and the counties have the authority to foreclose if the taxes aren't paid, and to sell the property then to get the taxes. So there's a very high proportion of property taxes collected simply for the reason that the asset that is being taxed is there and can be attached. On the income tax side, the debt is a personal debt until we reduce it to a more formal form through a warrant, and then we can record our warrants and they become liens on property. And if property is sold, then we're paid out of the proceeds. You asked about writing off on accounts receivable. We were just talking about that this morning. For our staff, I think it's very hard for them to recommend that we write off something unless they're really sure that the taxpayer is dead or will be unable to pay, and they're very, very confident they will be unable to pay. They don't like the idea of recommending writing off debt to the state because they know what the money is used for. So we do carry accounts receivable. We do have a reserve for uncollectibles in our balance sheets. We will write off if we are certain under our standards that the taxpayer will be unable to pay a tax debt.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative.
So then if I was to look at this, I would see not only the portion that's being attempted to be collected by the Department of Revenue, the portion that's being attempted to be collected by private collection agencies, but you have a separate portion that is actually, I can't remember how exactly you referred to it, sort of as your long-term uncollectibles or accounts receivable.
Mm-hmm.
Or would these two numbers here be, this would not be all that you would have collectible, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, if you're looking at page 36, the first line it says beginning inventory, they're under total inventory of accounts.
Right.
That's everything that we've got on our books as to be collected. So anything that has not been written off would be in that number. And that number might include some accounts that realistically will not be collected.
So, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please follow up.
So from that, if this amount that's down here in the private collection agencies represents a range of different types of collectibles in the terms of how old they are, your actual collection rates may be higher for the newer portions of those accounts than the older portions of those accounts, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes. The newer an account is, the higher the probability of collection.
Final question.
Please, Senator.
It's not on here, and I don't know if it's later in your presentation. You're also charged by a number of statutes to collect for other things.
Yes.
Do you have any records of, well, you do have records, I never. Do you have anything that would show us what you're collecting for other debts owed?
I do have that information. We have what we call our other agency accounts program, which was set up in the early 70s to provide collection services to other state agencies. We currently serve, I had a voicemail from the manager last night. He said, we have 119 clients, some of which might be multiple clients within one agency, but he said approximately 100 to 110 separate state agencies refer their debts to us to and use that collection service. They might use simply the income tax offset collection method, which the Child Support Division uses, or they might use our full range of services. And the court system also refers a substantial amount of debt to us, which includes restitution and unpaid fines. If we have someone, let's see, we collect traffic and parking citations for all the county courts. The Judicial Department oversees that. We have current receivables of about $174 million in debt assigned by all from all sources, courts, schools, businesses. Of the receivables, $130 million is for the Judicial Department.
That's included in the $317
million shown. It's included in 317. Where are you, sir?
$318 million.
Okay, now that's just personal income tax. That's not other agency. The numbers I'm giving you now are for our other agency program.
And so the collections by the Department of Revenue of $64 million in the 2002 year did not include other agency accounts.
That's just personal income tax.
Thank you.
Our collections for the state under other agency for 2001, there was about $200 million available for collection, and we collected about $16 million. In 2002, there was $254 million available for collection, and we collected about $19 million. So our percentage collection is somewhere between 7.75% and 8% over those 2 years.
Let me ask this, Director Archenko. Once you come to the final decision that, and of course all the publications, all the necessary filings of counties and those kinds of things have all been made, so there's been the public notice, that is, public filings for any assets that a person or entity may enjoy or own. At that particular point, when you get ready to write something off, and I assume that's done at the very high executive level when you make that decision, is that already been referred out for collection at that point?
Mr. Chair, the process that we go through is when we first set up a debt, whether it's somebody files and can't pay or have done an audit or have done a filing enforcement assessment, we will work that assessment for a year. And under House Bill 3509, after that year, we have to turn that account over to private collection for them to collect. If they're unable to collect, they will turn it back to us, and we'll put it in an inventory and work it in the ordinary course. But we follow the 1 year in-house and then out to private collection, and then if they conclude they aren't going to be able to collect, then
they return.
Send it back to us.
Okay.
When we provide services for other agencies through our other agency program, under House Bill 3509, the agencies have a year to try to collect. Then they will send it to us or to private collection. That's their choice. It has to be liquidated before it can come to us, which means that any appeal rights have to have been exhausted or expired. We will work it for a year, and if we can't collect, we'll send it back to the agency. And then they have to decide whether they're going to write it off or whether they're going to ask private collection for help again.
Okay, so with regard to personal income tax, of the net receivables of $318 million at the end of 2002,
mm-hmm.
You have an estimate of what may eventually be actually written off at that point?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an estimate of what's going to be written off. What we know that we will eventually collect most of the debt. It takes time, but we will eventually collect most of it.
So you don't. It's after a long, exhaustive period. When you decide that you're going to write it off, it's obviously already public because you've made all the necessary notices and filings. Do you make any public announcement as to what is being written off?
It's reported in our financial reports to the state.
By individual name?
No, not by individual name.
And the reason for that?
Confidentiality.
Wait a minute. We've already gone through the courts. We've gone through all of the public notification. What's the confidential nature of writing it off?
Well, if we write it off, it might not be in the courts. It might not be public. I mean, if you're talking about personal income tax.
Well, wait a minute. You filed and attached and done everything that you possibly can to try and get it back.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's going to be a whole range of circumstances. If we've set up an assessment, for example, where there's been no filing by the taxpayer, and if we've got something and it's a receivable and we're unable to find the person and we're unable to find any assets, then we're not going to spend the money to record a warrant if we can't find assets to attach or garnish. So there may be nothing in the public system.
I find that somewhat. We've gone through a very exhaustive election process, which may well have included court filings and certainly would have recorded any recordings that in places where there could have been any property. But for the fact that this person was this person or entity wasn't identified as owning any property in county X, Y, or Z, it wasn't filed there. But it would have been had we ever had any idea that they had any other assets in counties X, Y, or Z. Isn't that correct?
If we find assets, we will record.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so it's public at that point.
Right.
Okay. But when we get ready to write it off, we're not going to make it public?
Well, if we find assets, we're not going to write it off.
Well, but what I'm saying is, at that particular point, you don't know. And that's why I'm asking if it shouldn't become public at that point.
Mr. Chair, I think we're talking past each other. Can we go back?
Well, my concern is this, that and I don't know what portion of the $317 million may eventually be written off. If it's only 10%, that's still $31 million.
Okay. I'm trying to look at my balance sheet because I know we have an allowance.
Okay, now you've referred a couple of times to a balance sheet. We don't have a balance sheet in front of us.
No, you don't. Okay. I'm just looking at the monthly internal report.
Okay. Is there a balance sheet that's regularly reported by the agency?
I'll have to check with my finance manager whether we send this report to DAS or to Treasury or whether it's just a
LFO
record.
Gets,
do you get it monthly?
Yeah. I think it goes to the department and Darren gets a copy also.
Okay.
So I'm showing on, for example, for the end of March of 2003, we had total accounts receivable of $577 million, and the allowance for bad debts was 53.6.
So $577 million, that accounts receivable must include more than the income taxes.
Oh, it's everything.
Okay. All right. So that would include then the other agency account.
It would includes personal, corporate, tobacco, everything we collect that's other funds, anything we collect for local government. It's everything that we have as receivables.
I guess the concern that I've got is that you're trying to protect the anonymity of someone who the state is in the process of writing off. And I'm not gonna venture out to say that anonymity needs to be protected at that particular point if you've used all of the court system and all the public filing documents and all the rest of the mail to threaten those entities to, for goodness sakes, pay the debt which is owed, public debt which is owed. And I guess the concern that I've got is, well, what happens if I've got a loan shark out there that's still dealing with folks and still has monies coming and going, and you're in the process of writing off because they're outside the system?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you've lost.
I'm going to ask again.
Okay.
Could that information be made public as you get ready to write it off?
If we cancel an account, if we have gone through a public system, then I believe we could report somewhere that we are writing off an account.
So that the
we
public
can't
may
write
know.
Off unless we meet standards that have been approved by the Secretary of State and the Attorney General.
Okay. And so once those standards are met, then shouldn't that or could that information be made public?
I'm sure that some of it could.
Okay. Some but not all.
If we have an assessment internally and we have never used a public process because we've never been able to find either the person or assets, then there's nothing in the public arena about that taxpayer.
So I don't know whether
we cannot find a bank account, we cannot find property, we cannot find them. And so if we can't find property or bank account, we're not going to go to the expense to issue a warrant and a garnishment.
Okay, but basically what you've got then is a system which protects and is capable of being written off folks who are outside the system, who do not have bank accounts, who do not trade regularly in real property or other assets which are titled.
And we are very thoughtful about writing off accounts.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but basically after it's written off, or as it's in the process of being written off, it still protects that person who has maintained themselves outside the system.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me find out for sure exactly what we do when we write off accounts, whether that's
I would appreciate knowing that, because I'm still going to come back to the fact that I think that there ought to be some public information about those accounts which are being written off. Because there's a pretty good likelihood that person or entity, if they are still alive and or still potentially doing business somewhere and yet do not maintain a regular bank account or do not continue to hold real property in their own name, might have Trixie own it for them or whatever, mm-hmm. but they do not own it in their own name, but they have the beneficial use of assets, can continue to maintain themselves outside of the collection system as we're writing them off. When the public may be able to identify those folks who have assets, which may not be in the recordable fashion that the department is looking for.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, and that's my concern. Then I would like to have access to the balance sheet, and I would like to have us make sure that balance sheet is given to Senator Frank Morse. He's been asking for department balance sheets, and this is the first department that I've ever heard has a balance sheet, so... I'd like to have access to that. Make sure Senator Morse gets it as well. Okay, please.
Okay. Any more questions about collection, either our personal income tax?
I think we beat that one to death. We're going on the income tax strategies on page 39 and 40.
All right. Actually, I'm on 37.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair. During the 2001 regular session.
Oh, yes. I beg your pardon.
We were given additional positions. We actually turned in some positions, as Jim pointed out yesterday. When we experience productivity gains, we turn positions back, and then the governor recommends, or the legislature decides, or both, to give us additional positions to increase productivity. So we had... if you recall the process, the governor's recommended budget that came out in December of 2000 recommended that we be given an additional 39 positions to generate $20 million in revenue. And then after the March forecast came out, Governor Kitzhaber revised his recommended budget and recommended an additional 16 positions for an additional $7.9 million. And we were given all 55 of those positions. Then in February of 2002, during the, I think it was the second special session, we were asked to generate an additional $16 million in revenue without any additional resource. And we said we thought we could do that by doing a one-time shift of our folks away from their regular work to accelerate collection of accounts due. Through the end of February, we set targets for ourselves over time based upon what the tools were that we were going to use to achieve our commitments. And we had collected $38.1 million of the $43.9 million that we had committed. And our based on the experience that we're having and the amount of time that's left in the biennium, we're confident that we will... reach that 43.9 goal. Any questions about that?
We're still working on the marginal dollar, and it seems to be getting less and less as we continue to work on add more resources to that.
Now, why do you say that?
Well, originally, back in 1999, I think we were working on about a 10-to-1. And if I read this correctly, with 55 positions before the February 2002 special session where you were directed to see if we couldn't get an additional $16 million. We were after nearly $28 million up to that particular point out of the 55 positions. 55 positions costing us $5.4 million to generate $28 million isn't a 1 to 10.
Well, Mr. Chair, the 1 to 10 wasn't all staff. The 1 to 10 was audit, corporate audit staff.
But that,
and this is a mix. Ago. This is a mix of staff. The 55 positions is a mix of staff all through the agency,
mm-hmm.
and including technology staff, management staff, support staff, and revenue agents and auditors. That's why we have attached revenue production directly only to three classifications: revenue agents, auditors, and administrative specialists. But the rest of the department supports their work, providing the technology, the record keeping, and everything else that they need in order to be as productive as they are.
This is an 8.1 to 1 dollar of collection to investment.
The rate of return on the 2001 package?
On the totals, 43.9 million
mm-hmm.
on 5.4 million.
Mm-hmm.
is an 8.1 to 1 return.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The comment I made was that's down from where we started back in 1999 when we first concepted the idea or first discussed the idea of adding additional staff for accelerated collections.
And my response, Mr. Chair, was the 10 to 1 was corporate audit staff rate of return.
That's
there's
what
a
was
different
dedicated.
Rate of return for corporate auditors, individual income tax auditors, revenue agent threes, revenue agent ones, administrative specialists who work filing enforcement. They all have, as individual classifications, different rates of return for the position based on the work that they're doing.
So if
these
we added
packages,
10 positions today, if we added 10 positions today, would I expect an 8.1 to return to 1?
It depends, Mr. Chair, on the composition of the 10 positions.
But if you had your druthers wherever you were looking, could you do it again today?
What, 10 to 1?
Or 8.1 to 1?
If I could put a package together where that would be the rate of return. It would depend
could you
on
do it 10
what,
to 1?
It would depend on what the classification of the positions is. The other thing I have to think about is, do I have enough people to adequately supervise them? Do I have enough people to support the technology that they use so that they can continue to be as productive as they are? I think that the charts that we showed you earlier about the productivity mm-hmm. of the revenue agents indicates that all those systems that we're putting in place to support them is making them more effective and in terms of their production. But you do need to understand that we got to have a support system behind them in order for them to be that productive. So when you divide 55 positions, that was really quite a broad group. In fact, some of the positions in the governor's recommended were property tax folk that work in the property tax system to help support that system. So I think deriving a rate of return based on the 55 without knowing what that mix of positions is maybe not what you are trying to compare. It's apples to oranges.
I appreciate that. But is there a possibility that do you have some blend within the agency without burning out the golden goose that would still yield you a 10 to 1?
I have to go back and look and see whether we've got the capacity to take that many frontline staff without adding some supervisory support or technology support for those.
And adding the technology support would yield you something less than a 10 to 1.
Right, because you're going to have to. It's a team effort that produces those dollars.
Yeah. I just looking for any revenue possibilities.
Oh, I understand
that,
Mr. Chair. I understand that. And we've been asked by the Governor's Office and by the Department of Administrative Services to go back and look at what are you doing and are there ways that we can continue to invest and enhance revenue, and we're working on that.
Well, and in effect, what happens with the 8.1 to 1, really after the February special session, you were asked to do $16 million without an additional resource penny one.
That's right, and we made it very clear that in order to do that, we were going to have to shift folks away from what they normally do for a short period of time to meet that extraordinary goal, and that we would have to put them back, or the health of the tax system over the long term would be compromised.
Yeah, I'm not willing to compromise the structure and the health of the tax system.
Remember in the big circle that we talked about before, 88% of the dollars that come in are coming in from people who are trying to do it right.
Right.
We've got to support those people too.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Page 38 is our Treasury Offset Program Policy Option Package. We started using the Treasury Offset Program during this season, and through about 10 days ago, we had received $1 million in payments coming either directly from taxpayers who we had notified that we were going to refer their debts to the federal government for offset, or from the federal government as offset payments. We expect that during the next 2 years, we should receive about $3 million from this program. The cost is $249,700. The lion's share of that is actually the cost of notifying taxpayers, because in order to use the system, we have to notify them by mail that we're going to refer their debt for offset.
And that's from federal tax refunds primarily?
Right, federal income tax refunds. And the only debt we can offset is state personal income tax debt under the federal law, and so we need to have that amount of money in the budget in order to do the mailings and the notification in order to continue to use the program.
So federal law is the limiting factor.
Federal law requires us to do the notification. Yes.
But it also limits it to personal income tax.
Correct.
Debt. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Okay, income tax strategies, page 40, and I think we've had this conversation before, the last two biennia. Compliance for us isn't just enforcement, it is education and assistance as well. And looking at that revenue flow chart again, the education and assistance supports voluntary reporting. It supports employers doing withholding right. It supports taxpayers getting their estimated payments in correctly, filing their returns timely, and making their payments. And so those are important dollars for us to invest in that system.
Elizabeth, let me just interrupt you there. Going back to the collection activity and the audit portion of it. The federal advertises what its audit rates are. I think they're about 2%. Do we know what our state audit is, audit percentage?
The last news article I saw, the federal audit rate was less than 1%.
Okay.
And I think we're a little more than 1%.
You don't have those specific.
I know it's not quite 2%.
Okay.
Between 1% and 2%.
Good. Thank you.
So of all the general fund dollars that we collect, 88% are coming in that voluntary side, and that's what's reflected on page 42. Now, what we're trying to show you here is if we had 100% compliance in the income tax program, this is the breakout of what percent of dollars are coming in now voluntarily in the system, what percent of the total dollars that we think are out there are coming in because we're doing our enforcement work, and then what's still out there that we haven't been able to find yet. And these estimates, the estimate is based on information that we get from the service on their noncompliance estimates. Going to 43 through 46 are items of information about how we try to support that bulk of taxpayers who are trying to do it right. We have 6 field offices, and in the last couple of years, we've set up 3 satellite offices. And the satellite offices are actually a single person who has a desk, a computer, and a phone. Usually housed within another state agency's offices. We partner with Employment and Department of Human Services because they've got field offices all over the place. And so we'll send a person out from who will be connected with one of the field offices, and they'll be present then in a community where we don't have a field office. And it provides us an opportunity to be more visible in the community, to be a resource to the local professionals as well as to taxpayers. We've got a list of the kinds of things that our field offices and our main office provide, especially during the filing season. We try to extend our office hours. We try to keep our practitioners up to date on what's going on with Oregon tax law. We teach basic tax preparation to volunteers. We partner with the VITA program as well as with the American Association of Retired Persons in helping low-income and elderly people get their returns filed. We partner with the Internal Revenue Service. They have mobile tax assistance events as well as at the federal courthouse during the filing season. We've gone out into the high schools and community colleges. We try to provide as much assistance to people who don't speak English as we can. We focus primarily on Spanish-speaking taxpayers because that's a pretty good-sized group. So you can see, we get our field agents out there in community so people know that we're there and we're available to provide that support. We also do a lot of new business training with employment department so that as people start businesses, particularly if they have employees, they understand what their withholding and reporting obligations are. Page 44 and 45 are examples of posters and notices that we make available generally in the public. We post in grocery stores, post offices, schools, community colleges, libraries, anywhere where people are likely to be to give them information about our website, our phone number, and our assistance outreach events.
Hits on the web continue to increase?
Yes, the website hits have continued to increase. That was back on page 34.
Okay.
Then page 46 is one page from a website that we developed with students for students and people new into the workforce. One of our beliefs is that if you can get people who are new in the workforce complying, filing, and paying correctly and timely, that they'll get the habit and they'll do it over their working lifetime. And so we actually went out and worked with students to develop this website to help them start to get in that habit of understanding why they're paying taxes and how to do it. Page 47 shows how the income tax dollars are flowing in. Again, in the personal income tax system, the voluntary system, 82% of the dollars that we actually collect are coming in from people doing it right through withholding and estimated payments. And so the more easy we make it and more accurate that we're able to make those systems for them, the better the cash flow that comes in. 16% of those dollars are coming in with returns. And of the 2% of the revenue that comes in, that comes through our audit and collection efforts, most of the three-quarters of that is coming in through brief contacts with the taxpayers, either just a billing letter or setting up a pay plan for them. Page 48 identifies some of the primary tools we use in our enforcement efforts, obviously auditing. We review tax returns in our processing system to make sure that the return is internally correct, and then we also do audits to make sure that everything is being claimed correctly and the taxpayers are reporting all of their income and entitled to claim the expenses, deductions, and credits they're claiming. We're just bringing online a new automated compliance and enforcement system for our auditors so that they can do their work papers electronically. That's just been brought up in the last month or so, and the auditors right now are very excited about it. We're getting really good feedback from the staff. There's a better write-up of it in the resource materials at 1-17. We've got a publication that we call Focusing on Our Future, And there's a summary of what that new system will do for our auditors. Filing enforcement, we do use data from a lot of sources to figure out who should be filing if they haven't and to estimate their tax. And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to, at this point, let you know where we are in the project we've been doing with the Construction Contractors Board.
Mm-hmm.
We did a data match of their licensees against our 2001 database of filed returns. And let's see, what the numbers here. Of the individual, now the, they license contractors individually and as corporations and partnerships, and then also apparently LLCs are limited liability corporations and limited liability partnerships. So the numbers I have are kind of broken down into those big categories. The individual licenses, they had 22,800. Of those, 21,900 were Oregonians, and about 940 were had outside Oregon addresses. We did not have tax returns of record for those who had Oregon addresses. The 21,923 who had Oregon addresses, 3,200 we did not have tax returns for. For those who had outside Oregon addresses, of the 942, we didn't have returns for 343. For the corporations that were licensed that had Oregon addresses, there were 12,196, and of those, we didn't have returns for 3,621. For those that had outside Oregon addresses, there were 2,961, and there were 2,000 of those we did not have returns for. So we've developed a, or are developing a strategy for what to do now. We will be putting together a project to figure out how we want to contact those for whom we don't have returns.
High percentage of those with Oregon addresses had been filing returns.
Right.
Very low percentage of those that were companies not with Oregon addresses we're filing.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So maybe that they're maintaining an Oregon license and don't need to, or may not be working in Oregon.
That's right. So what we have to do now is we have to figure out a follow-up process to do a quick sift there. There may be some that are maintaining a license and didn't do anything during 2001 in Oregon, but that those that did, then we need to follow through. So we're working a pilot there.
Good.
And you have a bill that I think was up this morning that would authorize licensing boards to require proof of compliance before they issue a license or renew a license. We hope that passes because we'd like to begin to do pilots with some agencies to see how well that works so that we can report back during the interim and let you know whether that's a good tool for us.
Well, I appreciate the report on the Construction Contractors Board, because the proof of the pudding will certainly be in the eating there to find out if we do have some folks that, and it sounds like there's only 3,200, which is still over 10%, if I caught the numbers correctly, that are Oregon contractors with no tax return identified.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We think that this kind of work is going to be very helpful. The nice thing about the Contractors Board is they've been using Social Security numbers for long enough that they fell under a grandfather provision under federal law that they could continue to use them as an identifier for individuals, and that made the data match much easier for us.
Right.
So we will follow up on that, and I'll be delighted to keep you posted on as we learn and take significant steps
You've got all of those numbers there, and I would like to just take a quick look at those so I can kind of get visually the ratio of the numbers one to another.
Okay. I'll get a separate sheet for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Boy, am I getting close to the end?
Yes,
I am. I'm running out of voice here. Page 49, you've seen this before. This is a document that was developed by our collection staff based on the qualities and practices of the people they consider to be the most successful in doing collections work within our agency. And so these are the guiding principles that our collection staff use when they're working with taxpayers to collect. And then the last two pages in this part are illustrate a challenge that we have. Right now it's not huge, but it's something that we watch. And that is folks who are out there telling people that they don't have to pay taxes. And they tell people you don't have to pay federal taxes. And some of them tell people you don't have to pay state taxes either. And this Lynn Meredith, who is has been charged by the Internal Revenue Service and is going to trial in June, the left page 50 is a website page that shows that she did a event in Bend during 2001. This is challenging for us because periodically we do get from some taxpayers all of the arguments that, you know, I'm not a citizen of the United States, I'm not a citizen of Oregon, I'm only a citizen of Marion County. And therefore, I don't have, this is a voluntary tax system, and so I don't have to pay because I'm not a citizen. Or they set up what, they set up trusts and have their trustee be a third party. And so the reasoning is, well, since the trustee has title to the property, I don't have to pay taxes. But since the trustee isn't getting the benefit of the use of the property or the income, they don't have to pay taxes either. So this is challenging because these people are high maintenance in terms of the cost to try to deal with them. They generate huge amounts of paper and going through the appeals process. So just to let you know, this is part of the problem that confronts us as we deal with, particularly with filing enforcement. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Maneri, the Deputy Director of the Department. I have some Representative Johnson here, so let me return to a question that Representative Johnson had yesterday back on page 13. As we were dealing with the court fines and assessments program, Representative Johnson had asked about why revenues had been falling precipitously. So I went back and checked.
Or if they had.
So I went back and checked. And the court fines and assessments fall into two pieces. The Department of Revenue basically receives the revenues from the county justice courts and the city municipal courts. The circuit courts report through the judicial department. So coming from the justice and municipal courts, the revenue coming through has been pretty steady. The last 2 years it's been around $13 million and it's projected at $13 million again. So that segment is steady. The amount coming from the circuit courts was running about $45 million in 2001, but for 2002 it dropped about $5 million to $40 million, 45 to 40, and then it's projected to stay at 40.
Any reason why?
You'd have to ask the Judicial Department. Money comes through them and it's really their court.
We've tried to look at it. We just think they missed their projection. I mean, we've looked at it. We've looked at the filings. We've looked at all that. We had a whole, I don't know, hour and a half on CFAA in the Public Safety Subcommittee. It looks like it's dropping off, but it's dropping off based on their projection. We just think the Judicial Department, who makes the projection, missed the bogey on the projection. So, I mean, really, that's where it's at. We can't find any logical reason why it would drop off and really hasn't. It just hasn't climbed to the extent that they anticipated. And I think that the committee is inclined. We made some last legislative session, we made substantial changes in how the CFA was distributed.
Any indication that if the courts aren't fully funded and the courts aren't performing at optimal levels, that would have an effect on this?
Yes, and it's falling off now because we're not processing the misdemeanor caseloads and we're not processing a lot of the felony caseloads as well.
And so
they're not collecting the whatever it is now. It was $94, I think. When I was a DA, it's up now.
So it is dropping. Any indication of the impact on beneficiaries of that drop? I mean, the people that are paid out of that account?
It could be substantial. Could be substantial.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, with that, we'll return back to
page 53 and 54 on tobacco taxes. On page 54, again, seen this before, the processes we use for collecting both the cigarette and the other tobacco products tax. Basically, and then on 55, just a quick history because it's affected us dramatically. When we were back in 1994 with the 38-cent rate, we were a low state and really didn't see any significant compliance problems. Then as we raised our cigarette tax rate twice, we have seen some serious problems. So that in page 56, one thing that happens is when rates are significantly different in neighboring states, there's an economic incentive for moving cigarettes with the stamps. You can buy them in a low-tax state and then sell them in the high-tax state. Most consumers aren't going to look at the tax, the stamps on them. That's just one of many things. So in the last regular session in 2001, the legislature created a task force. In fact, it's the first one in the country that actually combines revenue department with the criminal state police and Department of Justice in with us on a task force. To take a look at this, on page 57, you can see the makeup of that task force. For us, I would say it was initially it was a different kind of agency for us to work for with law enforcement, but it's really working well now in terms of the what we're doing together. Let's turn to page 58.
Before you leave,
sure.
The activities that you're engaged in, I presume, range from investigation to actual patrol to my district is completely on the border with the state of Washington, and given that they're a high tax state, higher than we are, that would certainly have an effect. But without disclosing any of the police confidentiality, give us a sense of the spectrum of the work that the task force does.
I have to do that. And in fact, if we turn to 58, what we have is the combination is this. In the chain, you have the wholesalers buying from the manufacturers, the cigarettes, and then they distribute to the retailers who then sell to the consumer. So you have those pieces. What we're doing is the Department of Revenue with our staff deals with both wholesalers and retailers. So at the wholesale level, we will go in and audit wholesalers. And we will see if they are reconciling. They're supposed to, when they buy cigarette in the cigarette tax program, the wholesaler buys the cigarettes unstamped from the manufacturer, and then the wholesaler buys the stamps from that us. That's how we get the tax. And then they attach the stamp to the part to the, each cigarette pack, and then distribute it. So we'll go in at the wholesale level and do audits. Make sure that the purchases they're making from manufacturers reconcile with the number of stamps that they've been buying.
So I'm just curious. I know almost nothing about this. How many cigarette wholesalers are there in Oregon?
Well, I think there are about 80.
Okay.
So we do that kind of activity at the wholesale level. Then at the retail level, when a retailer receives the cigarettes, they buy cigarettes, they're supposed to be stamped. So we will go in and do inspections at the retail level to be sure that their inventory is all stamped. And in this last biennium we've done, in this biennium, we will probably be at about 8,000 inspections of retailers by the end of the biennium.
And are these unannounced inspections where you just show up and the team or some subset of the team just goes through their inventory?
Yes, we do. And in fact, we have there, and let me say, there are two programs. One is for the cigarette. So the tax is collected through the stamp. For other products, that would be mainly cigars and chew and other variety, but those are the two big ones. They are not stamped.
So what the what's done there is the wholesaler, when they sell them, they file a return quarterly and pay the tax. So we get a return in on those. But where, when we go into the retailer for the cigarettes, we look for the stamps. And then we also check the invoices of the retailer that they've been buying from the legitimate wholesalers.
And just to pursue this a little bit further, you go into a Quickie Mart somewhere in my district and the stamps are wrong. Then what happens?
We can confiscate the cigarette.
Okay.
So they lose their, they lose that inventory, and then there are also penalties.
Sure. Okay.
And, but the big loss for the retailer is the loss of that inventory. So there's that activity on our part. Then for the state police, they'll do investigations. They'll do reconnaissance, where they have tips in terms of or information from us that we'll gather at the retailer level on illegal activities, such as someone will take a truck up to Washington, and from a resource there buy unstamped cigarettes, or they'll buy the tobacco or chew products that haven't been taxed, and they'll transport them into Washington, into Oregon, and sell them to retailers.
Mr. Chair, are those largely then coming, if they're unstamped and they're in Washington, what's the genesis of that product, Canada or?
Well, it could be, for one, they can, where do they get their cigarettes unstamped?
One would think it would be much more attractive to slip over to Idaho. Or
well, you can do that. There's also, you can actually purchase counterfeit cigarettes, counterfeit stamps. There are overseas, there are countries that they will manufacture a carton of Marlboro cigarettes that are phonies, but they look just like Marlboro. And then if you're ordering these counterfeit cigarettes, you can order a stamp of your choice. So if you want Oregon stamps, they'll make Oregon stamps and put them on for you. And they'll ship them in, usually by boat. One of the interesting things is we've initially been able to detect those fairly easily because their stamps are a lot clearer than ours, the ones that we purchased. But so you have that kind of activity, and you have others where they can get these products and then try to bring them into Oregon and sell them without the tax. And we have the state police that will do patrols and tips. Will actually do surveillance on them to watch what they're doing.
One last question. What relationship does this task force have with Internet trafficking in illegal cigarettes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we are looking at Internet right now. It's a serious problem because there are a number of sites in this country and throughout the world where you can go in, where a consumer can go in, and it'll say no taxes, we'll ship it, and in fact, what the law is for the states is that the tax is on the consumer. It's a sales tax on a particular product. So if the tax is not paid, the consumer is supposed to pay, and there is a federal law that says that if you are shipping cigarettes into a state, you must report it to the state. And that federal law has not been observed by the Internet sites. So we have a partnership. We've had partnerships with a number of the federal agencies now, and there are now efforts and even suits in federal courts over getting compliance with that. Internet have become a serious problem for us.
Thank you. Please continue, Jim.
I might also mention another thing is that we do have a bill in this session. It's House Bill 2368, where we have partnered on the task force and with others, including the cigarette manufacturers, to shore up the current statutes. And the current statutes, well, we're going back to like 1960 when the statute was created. We didn't have these kind of problems, so. We've basically gone in and we're asking for civil penalties, and we're asking for the big difference is criminal penalties for either distributing without a license for fraudulently reporting. There's a number of areas there where the state police and the Attorney General's office working with us on the task force have says we can it'll give them a lot stronger tool.
Are those bills in process?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That bill has moved out of, I believe, the House Business Committee, and it's had a subsequent referral to House Revenue. So it's in House Revenue now.
Okay.
And moving to page 59, just reporting of the results. As of, first of all, on this current buy-in, as of the end of February, the target at that point would have been $291 million for cigarette tax, and we were $296. We're about $4.5 million ahead of target. So we believe by the end of the buy-in, we will hit the target or exceed it. Now, the same as with the other tobacco products tax. The big revenue revenue generator there is the auditing we've had. And our auditor has, we have the target there of $600,000 that we would collect. The auditor's already billed $1.5 million in audits, and cash in on those billings, we have over half a million right now. So the auditing is going exceptionally well. And, actually, we have a package where the governor is recommending that we add another auditor to that mix, limited duration, because we think we found quite a bit that we can audit in that area. In terms of inspections, we had told the committee, the Ways and Means Subcommittee, in 2001 that we do a little over 7,200 inspections. Given where we are now, I would say we're going to approach 8,000 by the end of the biennium. So we've been very aggressive. Inspections. On the task force, the state police and the attorney general's office have 60 criminal investigations ongoing right now, and have already have had two criminal indictments come down, and are expecting more. For the coming biennium with the task force, we expect to keep up the inspection level and generate more on the audit activity, and the criminal enforcement staff believe that they'll have about 100 new criminal investigations going.
Have you guys put together a POP on this bill? In terms of your budget, that it would include state police, the money for state police as well.
Mr. Chair,
I know the POP doesn't currently. Dallas, no. I just want to make sure you guys work with Dallas to put together a POP that would include the state police investigators as well.
Mr. Chair, what I understood from state police as we were going through the budget reduction issue was that they needed to have an other fund source in order to be willing to dedicate resource.
I understand.
We've provided language to Dallas that will accomplish that. It needs to probably be amended into our task force bill that's in House Revenue. But he has the language that would transform it to another funds. And then we would need to have either our budget changed or their budgets changed to be sure that there's enough money.
No, I understand.
Mr. Chair, Director Harshenko's been talking about is to completely fund the tobacco tax compliance task force, if you will, other funds shifted from general fund.
No, I understand. I think the issue that we've been discussing, though, with Chair Butler and myself and some other people, were to have a policy option package that you would purchase those investigative services from state.
So I think what I'm hearing then is still accomplish the same objective, but provide the additional general fund resources to the Department of Revenue, and then work like we did with this special session 6, for want of a better word, where you would contract in with the police.
Well, our budget request right now covers only our own staff.
Right, I understand that.
So if you wanted to add the cost of state police and DOJ, then
I understand that. That's all I'm asking is that we make sure we got the POP put together so that it's amended in that sort of way. That's all. All right. We can continue to move forward.
That covers the tobacco and tax force.
Okay.
It's going quite well. On to property taxes, page 63. Again, the revenue flow of property taxes with $3 billion going to schools is a foundation for funding schools. 64 and 65, just a comparison. The administration of the property tax system is a joint partnership between Department of Revenue and the counties. On 64, the department's function include everything from valuing the large properties, large industrials above $1 million in value, and also the transportation properties and the utility properties.
Senator Devlin.
Quick question. Have we been getting more requests on industrial and utility property, more industrial, in terms of reevaluating its value down?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we have been getting requests. They are industry related, and we've worked with the forest products industry ever since the 80s recession. In terms of adjusting their values, given plants closing. We now have had requests from food processing and both electronics industry over the effects of the economy on those, and so there are requests in there. We've been working with those industries to see if we can use data to identify loss in value. So the functions are laid out there for the department. On page 65 is the county side of that. So the property split is we do most of the large properties. The counties then assess the high volume of properties, homes and small businesses and others. We have the overlap of the mapping system where we provide state standards and do some of the work and help out the counties and their mapping function. Then page 66, this is just a reminder that like we talked about a little earlier, is that the system with Measure 5 and Measure 50 has become quite a bit more complicated than what we had before that. So that's has taken resources to basically work out the issues there and to operate it. I don't know if you recall, but Elizabeth was mentioning yesterday that for some accounts, for like farm use, you have to maintain 5 values for the account. That's what really the workload's down there. On page 67, then, again, it is a partnership, and we do work closely with counties to operate the system as a state system rather than 36 separate county systems. And we've always enjoyed a good constructive working relationship with the counties on that. On page 68, the mapping program is in the time I've been around, has evolved dramatically from paper maps. When I first came into the department, you could go down in our mapping area and find the big drafting boards with the people sitting there with the deeds, redrawing the lines when people changed properties. And the digital age has really hit mapping. The software improved dramatically in the late 80s and early 90s. The legislature funded a program for us in 1999 with a dollar fee on documents filed through the counties that has really helped launch us a lot faster into that digital age. What we have is a project going, it's called ORMAP. With funding helps move the county mapping under a common standard from paper onto digital and then onto geographic information systems. So the difference being is that when you move from paper to digital, in the simplest sense, what you have is you can look at that map on the screen, on the computer, and there are advantages to that. You can change it on the screen. The geographic information system jumps it up a couple levels, where the information captured on the map and in the computer now is more of a dynamic where you can match it with other information. So let me just give you an example. A simple example is you can take a map of a neighborhood or an area, and now you can overlay the floodplain on it and see right where the floodplain crosses in terms of properties and their locations. One of the more
dramatic late examples of the use of this technology is with 911 emergency type services in states, and that is you can take your map system, overlay the roads, you can get estimates on road travel time, you have the bridges in there, and now a dispatcher sitting at a screen can get a call. They could get a call, and the spouse is calling, and their spouse has had a heart attack, and they're so traumatized by it, they can't even tell you where they live. So you've got a caller ID, will bring it up, it will match the telephone number with the address and pull up the map where the home is. Then the global positioning system can have computers and all the emergency vehicles that are out, and it will show up on the map where they're all located. The dispatcher can see that. And the computer can calculate the estimated time from each vehicle, given the roads they would travel, to get to that location and identify for the dispatcher the ones that can get there the fastest. Now, the latest technology then, I saw this demonstrated, was that if you have a, let's say that the bridges are maintained by a county, and you have a county engineer out in the field and determines that the bridge is no longer passable, they can take a handheld device, pull up the map, change the code on the bridge from green to red, transmit it via satellite into the web, and it will change it on the system automatically. And when it changes it on the system, the computer then will recompute all the times from the vehicles having to go around that bridge and show you which vehicles are faster. I gave you that example. It's a matching of a lot of databases that becomes very valuable in terms of not only emergency services, economic development. You can locate available industrial sites and all kinds of information about them, post them on the Internet so that potential companies looking for a site can actually go in on the Internet and start looking at what's available. The technology seems unlimited on what it will do, but the foundation for building this in any state is building the base layer, and the base layer is really what's contained at the assessor's mapping level. It's the outlines of, it's the property dimensions, acreages, ownership information, and a lot of other very valuable information that can be used in these systems. So if you build that base, then all of your data can be laid on top of it and become very valuable. The department is working with the counties on this and is working with the Department of Administrative Services has a state Geographic Information System Coordinator, Cy Smith. We're working on that in terms of not only the counties, but also the state agencies and the data they have that could be brought into this big mapping system and be used.
It seems from the list of folks that you gave, the agencies and the partners, two are conspicuously missing. And I'm hoping you'll correct me. ODOT, given that they have extensive mapping capabilities, and I hope they're part of your team, and Oregon Economic and Community Development. Are they involved at all?
Yes, Representative Johnson. Yes, they're involved through the Oregon Geographic Information Council that the state coordinator is involved. So what we're doing as a state agency is coordinating a lot of the information around the assessor's maps, so we're working closely with assessor's offices and vendors and others to build that base layer. And then we're part of the council that the state coordinator has set up, which involves ODOT and the other state agencies, to look at the state data and see how it can come into it.
I guess what I'm interested in hearing from you is some interest in pushing OECDD. We have heard now from the governor that one of his goals is to prioritize, as a priority, is to streamline land use applications and time that people are spending at the counter trying to understand what they can and cannot do by way of development. And it seems to me, given the tools at your disposal, that you serendipitously end up in the very forefront of being able to create those tools. And it seems to me that if the governor is giving direction, you hear both caucuses, both sides of the building, talking about streamlining processes. I'd like to see some
stepping up of OECDD to help pay for some of these activities. I mean, this just seems to speak to the core of what their business is, which is to make it easy for business to come to this state and look around and see the opportunities, the impediments, to be able to have a map that overlaid wetlands. To me, is just a tool beyond measure at a time when that seems to be a particular sticking point over and over again. And given the money that sloshes around in OECDD, getting some assistance for your agency to help with this coordinated mapping effort, particularly with the benefit at local government, seems to me to be there's just an urgency about it.
Representative Johnson, Marty Brantley, the new director,
right,
I think, once some of the pressures of the session and the getting out and raising awareness of Oregon is behind him, has already said he's planning on pulling together a group of agencies, including revenue, to see where the partnerships arise. So I'll be sure to bring that up when we get together and have that meeting. The potential of the mapping is something that only the imagination limits, as Jim just described. And there are counties that are doing some tremendous work on their own geographic information systems. And it really is getting knowledge all pulled together.
Well, and I guess what I'm looking for is I'd like somebody at the state level to own that process. And it just seems to me logical that OECDD would step up. I'm taking advantage to use all these acronyms while the chairman is out of the room. It seems to me that this would be a place where they could step up both with money and with coordination, because we've got county efforts going on. I'm delighted to look at this and see that one of my counties is in the vanguard of the ones that are quite ahead. Rather than having all of these little pockets doing it, I would welcome the chance to hear some state agency say, we own this, this is our responsibility. I happen not to think it's with you, and that discloses my own bias, but to encourage you to talk to Mr. Brantley and see if there's an opportunity for the state's chief economic development agency to actually own something that has some real application on the ground for both current business retention and future business development.
Well, certainly, Representative Johnson, the Department of Administrative Services feels a lot of ownership of this as a coordinator and collaborator in bringing agencies together. But I will be happy to talk to Marty and see where the role for economic development.
That would be great. Or Mr. Weeks. I mean, I just want somebody to say it's our agency's responsibility to make sure we're getting all the right folks at the table.
Will do.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The over on 70 and 71, when we first started, you can see the on top of page 70, we divided this into three categories to try to see the progress. One is white is the county to some extent is still on paper maps. Actually, if you look at that map, you'll see that Washington and Clackamas are, but again, it's white if they are still to some extent on paper. So they are, they're working toward it. They're not just paper. They're a mix right now, and it'll take the bigger counties longer to get there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
This may be an example of your intergovernmental workings. Metro has had an operating GIS system since 1988 or 89. They probably have the most sophisticated GIS system probably in the state. Not all of those three counties are actually mapped, although they are to some detail outside Metro's boundaries. But you can see that that's been in existence for over a decade. But the assessors don't have it.
Would it be safe for the committee to conclude that it was enlightened leadership at Metro that set this pace to propel Metro ahead in these efforts?
Yes, it was. And by the way, Madam Chair, the chair left with me the responsibility of regulating the regulator, in terms of the use of acronyms. Just kidding.
And what do I always just judge you? Would you please continue?
Thank you. Just mentioning that we've divided the state into regions. Actually, we've let the counties choose their own regions and their working partners. Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington are a region, and Metro does participate in that region. So, and we're happy for that. The grayish. Is that the county has moved from paper to at least a digital stage, but though it's not geographic information system ready yet, and the black would indicate that they are ready for geographic information system applications.
I'm sorry that the chair isn't here to note that Harney County, progressive county that it is, was also way back in 2000 one of the few up to speed and doing this.
Yes, Harney was actually was quite fortunate. A number of years back, Bureau of Land Management was looking for a pilot project, and Harney County was very attractive for what they needed, so they funded the project and came in and did the work and built that base for them. So that was a really good partnership. Mount Gear, actually, next door, we're working on a conversion project for them that will be finished in 2005, and they will be geographic information system ready at that point. Actually, for the you can convert the counties with sparser populations a lot faster than you can with a lot of subdivisions and a lot of divisions of property. So we can actually move over a number of these counties in a number of years to have the base. You can see then. 3 years later, in 2003, as this project developed, we're moving more counties along off of paper into a digital or a geographic information base size. One of the white counties is Union, still on paper, but actually they're going to be converted. And the interesting thing about Union County is the partnership there included county and two cities, Vista Utilities, Natural Gas Deliverer, two federal agencies and others who came together, and actually they pulled some money in and used some of the money from the project, and they'll be converted in a couple of years too. So we've had some really good partnerships. We're over on page 71 at the top. We see by the end of 2005, that's where the counties will be, and the goal is for 2008 is to have all counties. We actually have a statewide base available for geographic information system applications. And that's been the goal of the project, to build that base. So we have one state system to do that. Page 72 and 73, just a little about our industrial program. $17 billion in value in terms of the plants that we appraised throughout the state. And you can see the locations of those on page 72. On 73 is since 1993 we've had stable staff. Though through productivity increases and automation, we've been able to, with the same level of staff, handle a greater and greater workload with the values. And usually, as the values grow, typically the complication grows. And as pointed out earlier, we have, along with the values, we've had to work with industries over particular effects of the economy on their industry to work out value adjustments in terms of what the economy is doing to them. And on 74 and 75, our centrally assessed program, which is your transportation properties and utilities, high tech. No, high tech's industrial, I'm sorry. The values as they're distributed throughout the state, and then a similar thing is that we've basically only increased two staff levels, a higher workload, so we've taken advantage of productivity automation there. And that finishes the presentation.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, can I throw a question totally out of left field?
Sure.
There's discussion going on in this building, and I'm not endorsing that discussion. That's the disclaimer. And because we have the Department of Revenue here, and because I think this would be a major undertaking, if this state ever had a sales tax, how long would it realistically take to implement in terms of the mechanisms that would be necessary? It's an extremely complex system, actually. Just in your estimation, Sullivan.
18 months. And
the
interesting thing about it is the states that are sales tax states across the country have been working towards more uniform systems. So we have the benefit of all that work that they've done, which would make the administrative, our side getting ready, probably more efficient than it would otherwise be. The real challenge is for the retailers, because they have to buy cash registers that can calculate sales tax. They have to teach their employees that they have to now deal with sales tax. We're going to have forms and publications and returns. And it's all the relationship with the retailers, who are the collection agents for the state of their general retail sales tax, that takes the time. We thought about 18 months from the legislature passing the legislation to being able to have revenue coming in the door.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, that's not an endorsement of the proposals, but I just thought it's interesting because that's about where I thought it would be. And in terms of some of the discussions going on about it, it might be a potential source. I'm not saying that, but a potential source in 03-05, it's not.
Representative Patridge.
How many cash registers can you buy that don't have a sales? Can you even buy cash register? It's so prevalent across the United States.
Well,
there are so few states that don't have a sales tax. I just question whether it takes 18 months to put something on the ground. I guess I would narrow the question to say, how long would it take for the Department of Revenue to be ready, as opposed to the retailers to be ready? You don't have to answer that question now.
12 months for us. Don't forget, we'd have to hire. We'd be starting from ground zero.
Oh, we understand that.
Take advantage of everything we could from other states.
Current FTE.
No, we couldn't do it with current FTE. Actually, sales tax is a pretty intensive program in terms of administrative cost. It's a lot more intensive than the personal income tax.
I guess Senator Devlin.
Chair, I was just going to say, just for the record, too, is that I think a number that I saw, and I think it's about right, 2.5% of U.S. residents live in jurisdictions without a sales tax.
Non-sales tax states are pretty small population states. There's only 5.
Again, without endorsing any proposals that are currently active in the
I'm a Republican, and I didn't even give that caveat.
Are you doing any groundwork now just in terms of, I know you're preoccupied with the session, but has the department given any administrative time over to thinking about what all your personnel requirements would be or a strategy should the legislature go that direction?
Well, the last time the legislature seriously considered a sales tax was about 10 years ago, and we did a lot of work then thinking about staffing, but it hasn't seemed like it's had legs under it, and my expectation was that we would probably be looking at the 05 session for major tax restructure and work being done preliminarily during the interim, and we probably will do some work during the interim to be prepared for that possibility, because that'll be a question that the legislature will want to know. Well, if we do this, how much is it going to cost us to administer?
Well, given the time, and I think we're at a break point now. Dallas, do you have any guidance to give us?
Well, no guidance, ma'am. Madam Chair, we will be pursuing going to work session. We'll be preparing with the vacancy issue, the zero inflation issue, also the issue with the providing the general fund to, or however to fund the police activities in DOJ for the tax compliance task force. So we will be doing that for the Department of Revenue. I would like to let you know that tomorrow's agenda, since the department will be here, they're pretty much wrapped up. There'll be one relating to elections. House Bill 2145 is on the agenda for tomorrow, and that's the one that sets up the fund to capture the federal, so the federal funds can come in and go to it. And Thursday, we're scheduled for an informational briefing by Department of Administrative Services Facilities, particularly with respect to those non-uniform rent length adjustments.
And I hope that you would speak to them about being able to comment on the retroactivity of some of the assessments.
Madam Chair, Ms. Warner will be prepared for the whole issue.
Great. Are there any other questions by the committee?
I have a question, please. Do you need us back tomorrow? We finished the presentation in chief, but I didn't know whether there was any other conversation you wanted to have about our budget or program priorities or anything else, or whether that all waits till work session.
I think that's for Tom to decide.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
I don't anticipate that there would be a great interest, but have we opened this in terms of a public hearing yet, in terms of, or would we do that?
It's posted already.
Yeah.
For tomorrow?
This, it's posted for public hearing tomorrow, so if you would like.
Well, given that it's posted for public hearing, then we should go ahead, and at least make the opportunity available if there are folks that are going to testify prior to moving ahead with any consideration of House Bill 2145. But I'm pretty far out ahead of myself. I don't know what the will of the chair is or whether he's given you any indication of his preference, Mr. Wynan.
I haven't. I haven't had a discussion with that, and I've heard of no other issues that they might want to discuss.
Okay, we'll stay connected with you then, and yeah, as you have a chance to talk to him, if you need us here tomorrow.
How fortunate.
How fortunate.
Mr. Chair, we are just in the process of having a discussion about tomorrow. Given that the presentation has been finished and we're at a stopping point right now, it has been posted for public testimony, and we were awaiting your return to give us guidance on how to proceed.
Take public testimony wherever possible.
Okay.
But does the department have to?
Do you need us back?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know of any reason, having completed the information today, I don't know of any reason why you folks need to return. We know where you're at.
Really? We're taking returns in today.
I know that you are.
Did everybody file?
With that, we'll just go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow. Thank you. Director Tinkle, or maybe...